Hello, folks, and welcome back to Pixels and Profits with my co-hosts, Matthew Contraman and Brian Peganoff. Today, we are going to be talking about two public gaming companies that have been beaten down a bit, and we will discuss their current business, reasons for their current performance, valuation, and future outlook. And those two companies are the Embracer Group and Ubisoft. And finally, we'll kind of compare the two companies and give our thoughts on which of the two companies has the higher potential to break out in the future. And so just to go ahead and just get this thing kicked off, I think we could start with Embracer. So what I'll do is just do a quick overview on the business, and then I'll kick it over to Matthew to talk about the financials. So in terms of the Embracer business, they are a fairly scaled roll-up of many game studios across PC, console, mobile, and even board games and other kinds of media like comic books. And they basically grew during ZIRP, the zero interest rate kind of policy environment, easy money times, but now we're in a new environment. And so in terms of the company itself, the head office is based out of Sweden and owned at least a year ago, 12 operational groups, THQ Nordic, PlayOn, Coffee Stain, Amplifier, Game Invest, Saber Interactive, Deca Games, Gearbox, EasyBrain, Asmodee, I don't know how to pronounce that, Dark Horse, Free Mode, and Crystal Dynamics, Eidos. And the group at that time owned 850 franchises, 138 internal game studios, and had 16,600 employees across 40 different countries. So we're talking about a pretty big scaled organization that's global. And further, the high-level organization of the company is based off of four operating segments: PC and console games, mobile games, tabletop games, and entertainment and services. And that last category is mainly things like, as I mentioned, comic books, manga, physical games for consoles, and publishing and distributions of actually film and TV shows. Now, since that time, about a year ago, Embracer over the past year has been shifting its business. They've closed down a few studios, including Volition Games, the developer behind Saints Row, and Free Radical Design, known for the Time Splitter series. And further, more recently, Gearbox, known for Borderlands series, was sold to Take-Two, and Saber Interactive, known for World War Z, was also sold. And even beyond that, their in-house game publishing team, the former Perfect World USA team, which then became Gearbox Publishing, they got spun out as Arc Games. And so that's just like a high-level overview of the business and the company. And with that, Matthew, if you want to go over the financials of the company, that would be great.
Yeah, so this is a weird one, and I'm actually not going to go like super, super deep on the numbers because the numbers are really kind of unknown at this point because of how much they've sold, right? We're all kind of waiting to see when they report their fiscal year earnings sometime in May, kind of like what, I mean, they in all these deals, it's always like what they retain, what they sold, et cetera. So I did my best napkin math to kind of come up with what the business looks like going forwards. But, you know, it's still very, very kind of, we need to exactly see where all the pieces fall to see exactly what this business looks like now and then going forwards. But overall, you know, as you kind of laid out, this was a roll-up story during the ZIRP era. But unlike what we saw with like Zynga during the 2010s, where they bought these studios and kind of made them their own little city states that then scaled from there, all of these studio organizations did everything independently. There was no central functions. There was no synergies. There was no cost savings. It was literally just financial valuation arbitrage. Buy cheap assets, put them in a parent company that's valued at more on a valuation basis than these private assets, and use stock to do it. So that way you're creating arbitrage. And that works as long as your stock price keeps going up and your stock valuation is greater than the valuation of private assets. As the valuation arbitrage went away and as interest rates started going up, there was fewer deals to be done because they couldn't take advantage of a relatively expensive equity currency to do deals anymore. And interest rates were going up. And the last few deals they did were large ones. They did the Lord of the Rings acquisition for the IP. They did Asmodee, which is huge. I think that was $3 billion, if I'm not mistaken. It was a large deal. And they took on more and more debt to do these large deals towards the end of this cycle. And with European companies, and Embracer is a good example, they used bank loans as opposed to corporate debt. and that's all floating rate debt. And so when spot interest rates started going up, your interest expense, which is a spread over the benchmark rate, which was zero, now that's a spread over 4 or 5%, whatever the benchmark rate. I haven't looked specifically at the loans, but it's usually some overnight SOFR rate or whatever. So you're talking about going from 1.5 to 2% cost of debt to 6.5 to 7% or whatever it is, right? And so that completely changes the P&L when your interest expense goes up by that much, right? Both in terms of the quantity of debt you've taken on, and then also the rate on that debt. And so now that what they've had to do is to meet their debt covenants. And for those that are not familiar with credit markets, covenants are restrictions placed on the borrowers by the lenders or the creditors, in this case, the banks doing the bank loans, that say you need to maintain certain financial measures or we can force you into default to make you pay us back our money, right? And so they had certain terms, certain covenants in these debt, which basically said they had to maintain certain, you know, valuations of EBITDA, interest coverage, et cetera, things like that. And they were getting very close to breaching that. And so that precipitated this huge deleveraging plan, which included all these large asset sales that kind of you discussed with Sabre, Gearbox, et cetera, and also internal restructuring.
I think, like, in terms of the debt, how existential of a threat is the debt in terms of the scale of the debt and based upon ZIRP low interest, and now we've got high interest, and as you mentioned, it's floating. And just, I really want to underscore for the audience, this could be pretty serious, right? Depending on the scale of the debt. Is this a potential existential threat given how much debt that they currently have?
These things tend to be long, slow bleeds. They don't happen overnight. You know, traditionally, solvency crises don't happen overnight. Liquidity crises can, right? You know, if they start to hit a maturity wall and they can't refund it because the bank shut them out for some reason, then a liquidity crisis becomes a solvency crisis. But with all these divestitures to raise cash, you know, even Sabre and Gearbox will get them $500 million ish of cash net after all of the expenses to sell the stock and everything from take two, right? So,
okay.
You know, when you kind of think about what they've done, it's not existential now. Famous last words, as I said, with NVIDIA, and I've been wrong since then, right? But, you know, based on my napkin math that I did looking at the numbers, it seems like they've probably done enough, at least in the near term, to avoid that significant risk in the near term. Mm-hmm. But obviously, now it's all predicated on execution, right? Because if the games that they release don't execute and they miss their numbers and EBITDA comes down further, you're back in a situation where, well, okay, the debt ratio of net debt to EBITDA is a numerator and denominator, right? You can reduce that by reducing the numerator or increasing the denominator. But if the denominator goes down, your leverage ratio goes back up, right? And so I remember this back in my days covering telcos when I started as a junior analyst. And, you know, there's a lot of telcos that go through this issue. They're highly leveraged and they do all these weird, you know, financial engineering things to avoid liquidity crises. EBITDA comes in short because it always does because it's a dying business. And then they have to do it again. So I'm not going to sit here and say that that's what I expect to happen for Embracer, but that is still a risk. But I think the near-term risk of a significant event has probably gone down because of these moves that they've done. And so if we look at the numbers at the end of 2023, they had about $1.5 billion US dollars of debt. It was 16.1 billion SEC. If we think about what they've done to reduce that with the sales, you're probably looking at 465 to 500 million based on the filings they did for the Gearbox and the Sabre deals. These assets they sold were also loss-making. This is on a EBITDAC, which is EBITDA before the, it also includes the capitalized R&D, because for those that don't know, accounting things between Europe and the US, in the US, you have to expense most of your R&D on games, but in Europe, you get to capitalize it. So you don't actually hit the P&L, but it's still a cash outflow. So that kind of adjusts for those differences. And so, you know, it actually helps their profitability because they're selling assets that were losing money, that again, based on the filings. And so I think their debt covenant is 2.5 times of adjusted EBITDA. That's the main one for the debt that they have. And so this should keep them in compliance, at least for now, with their debt covenants, with what they're doing, with how much they've sold, how much they've raised, and actually selling loss-making assets to help their EBITDA as well. So what's left of the business? Okay, so I tried again to do some napkin math to kind of guesstimate what's left. In calendar 2023, the core business that's left, which is the studios they haven't sold, is about $3.6 billion of revenue. So still a substantial large enterprise as a whole, and still with about 11,000 employees in about 135 games in development. So by no means a small organization, right? It's just a lot smaller than it was 12 months ago or so. In terms of segment revenue and profit contributions, JK, as you mentioned, with all of these moves, I actually think the tabletop games business is now the largest by revenue. And I think also by profit as well, it's going to be the largest segment. So,
yeah, you know, that was a really surprising thing to me when I was looking at their financials. It's like, wow, their tabletop business is this big. It's like
So, you know, just to kind of wrap it up, and then I'll pass it to Brian for any thoughts, because this is, I know we've chatted a lot about this, but, you know, when you kind of put the PC and console and mobile games together, that makes up the rest of the business. And together, they're large. But yeah, you know, so they still have, I listed down the studios they still have. So they still have THQ Nordic, PlayOn, Coffee Stain, Crystal Dynamics, and Eidos Montreal. And that's on the PC and console side. And then on the mobile side, they still have Easy Brain, Deca, and Crazy Labs. So whole mess of a financial engineering. And, you know, if you love debt and you love special situations, this is all for you. But it's definitely a complex story. And I hope I did a good job of explaining it. Brian, I know you want to jump in and talk about some things here.
Yeah, it's funny. I think when we designed the content roadmap for our shows for the next few episodes, we were thinking about, I guess it was around GDC, and everything was really expensive, right? Like, tech was screaming up every day, and we're recording this on Thursday night. So a little bit different backdrop here. So the rationale behind going behind a few laggards was, you know, are these catch-up trades with everything else working? But anyway, really sorry that you had to do so much work on Embracer. It feels extraordinarily immature to me as a company still. I don't really mean that in a negative way. Like you guys have noted, it was built by financial engineering, lacks a specific focus or energy outside building games with a bunch of studios and launching them. And part of me likes the purity of that. It's exciting at a certain scale of profitability and revenue mass, but for all intents and purposes, their current strategy is a restructuring program, and that's supposedly wrapping up. So it's, you know, it's a bit boring. This is definitely, from a development perspective, the old shotgun approach to video game publishing versus today's more sniper mentality at the big publishers, where they focus on the biggest and best franchises only, and then small measured shots on goal. But, you know, as it stands now, Embracer's success in generating free cash flow for the foreseeable future is going to go toward servicing debt alongside selling some, you know, key strategic assets and IP. I still haven't fully gotten over the whole $2 billion of revenue without a term sheet guidance. The stock has been dead flat since then when we last talked about it, and rightfully so. I've also had some personal disappointments here, like the last Saints Row game in 2022. What a mess. I still think that game has like a special future if the right team is behind it. But, you know, that IP stayed with them after the Gearbox sale to Take-Two. They do have some good games though too, right? Like Remnant 2, it's one of my favorite games of the year so far. Deep Rock Galactic, pretty cool. So I'll certainly be pulling for the company long-term. And we all have friends there that are in that organization or are parts of that organization. And I think Lars does have good intentions for the gaming industry. Heard good things about him as an operator. But some of these like cyclical issues, you know, it's hard. This is not an enviable job, right? Like, you know, shuttering studios and firing folks and things like that to get costs contained out of due necessity, it's got to be tough and it's got to be weighing on them. But I guess I'll leave it there and see what JK thinks.
I was just going to say, my big problem with Embracer, and it ties to Ubisoft as well, who we're going to talk about next, is you've got 135 games in development. How many of them are going to sell more than 10 million units on console, right? Yeah. The problem with the games industry, and to your point about being snipers with the large publishers and not the shotgun approach, is economies of scale and profitability of scale in gaming doesn't come from having lots of games that sell 2 million units. It comes from having three games that sell 20 million units, like Activision and Blizzard does, right? And so that's the problem here, is even if some of these games are great and the teams are fantastic, it doesn't really move the needle, because like it's just, you have a bunch of like, I mean this not in a negative way to the teams that build them. Again, this is a financial conversation, that you have a bunch of games that kind of like don't matter and don't move the needle for an organization this large. And so, yes, they can be profitable and they can be cash flow positive, but unless you have so many of them that are doing that, or you have a select few that really hit that scale, it just doesn't move the needle. And that's kind of the big problem here is you have all these unsynergistic assets and no centralized strategy to extract value from them, more so than just having them as be separate pieces. You know, I joked about it in a chat with us, but like, what if Embracer built their own mobile app store, mobile and PC and console game app store, and competed with what Epic is doing with all of the studios and games they have, right? What if they built a subscription service for all of the games they have? I don't know if it'd be more or less successful, but there's no centralized strategy to take advantage of all these assets. It's just, we have a bunch of games and we're going to release them and see what happens.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of like a mom and pop development studio, right? ETF with leverage.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting contrasts when we talk about Ubisoft and when we talk about Embracer. To your point, Matthew, like the difference in terms of the strategy is as far as like going for scale, big hits versus kind of, I mean, not necessarily like, you know, back catalog, but not necessarily like the top tier as far as scale. And if we're moving towards an industry or environment in which we have greater parallel distribution in terms of outcomes, and in which more games are moving towards live operations, so that it gets harder and harder to take time away for more like, you know, B tier, C tier type of games, then it may be rough sledding for these guys. But, you know, so before we jump into like the future outlook for the company, I thought maybe also if you guys could speak a little bit about, you know, your thoughts on the valuation, like from a investor or financial perspective, how do you currently think about how they're currently valued today?
Yeah, I mean, I'll jump in and I'll pass it to you, Brian, because I know we've chatted about this and you have some thoughts here. In terms of like, on paper, the valuation's cheap. You know, I think it trades less than 1x trailing sales and like under 9x adjusted EBITDA, adjusting for the capitalized R&D. So like, not expensive on paper, but this is a special situation, you know, and when I say that, I don't just mean it's like special, it's Embracer. Special situation in finance means there's like this whole bankruptcy risk thing plays a factor in the equity valuation. And what I say that is, when you have highly leveraged companies, the equity of that trades more like a call option on the default risk, because a lot of creditors will actually short the stock as a hedge against a long bond position that are playing the distress. If they're playing it as a distress play, that's a very common trading strategy. I experienced that a lot with the telcos I used to cover, because a lot of them were distressed, right? And so, you know, the equity being cheap doesn't necessarily mean that it makes a good investment, because you have lots of weird dynamics around distress structures that come into play with special situations like this. I do think overall, like, if you step back and you look at everything they've culled and the steps they've taken to realign their business, it is, you know, applaudable to a degree how deep of cuts and how aggressively they've sold assets to right-size the ship. If you were really aggressive and risky, you might be looking to potentially nibble on some equity here at a cheap valuation. And, you know, maybe we get some rate cuts, who knows, that then also fuel the fire. But for someone like me, it would be too premature. I'd like to see a couple quarters of what the numbers look like and kind of them executing on sustaining the profitability growth and the cash flow that they need. But if you're kind of looking to be early, you could start nibbling and see what happens. Brian, are you nibbling here?
No. I mean, the stock, it doesn't come up very much with institutionals, given the market cap now, the trading liquidity in exchange, and then, you know, the loss of credibility we talked about the last time. So I don't see a ton of urgency getting involved right now. But, you know, if you're bullish on the video game industry and have high hopes for 140-ish launches to be absorbed well into a very competitive market, there's some value here. Like that could all change if they have like a dead ass hit, right? Like a game that's just absolutely massive. And if you're taking 140 shots on goal, maybe that's in there somewhere. So that would get me interested. The mobile business is not super interesting. It's like 500 million run rate. They've kind of wound back revenue, but spending less on UA. So MAU and DAU are on a decreasing trend, but it's probably how you want to manage that business. So the upside really has to come from PC console. And that's got to be like a high def, you know, co-op, multiplayer type of experience. It's not going to be these single player games that can only sell like 5-6 million boxes. I do think it's a nice PA trade to set and forget about for a year, but to put, you know, real capital to work here, I think, like you said, I need to see another quarter or two to see how all this math shakes out and how the numbers get massaged. it's just that there's a lot of moving parts right now. And, you know, especially in the context of the market we're operating in right now, everything is down quite a bit. Earnings are coming up. There's earnings catalysts and people are going to flock back to certain names. But this kind of stuff in that backdrop just kind of stays dead in the water unless there's some huge, huge catalyst.
What you're saying harkens back to what I said. Like, a lot of the games that they make for console and PC, and I know subscriptions are kind of, were a buzzword and now are kind of not, but like, these are the games that make sense in a Game Pass, right? Single player games that are consumable in under 20 hours. Like, right. Embracer should be considering different distribution models that take advantage of the assets they have rather than competing with the games that are out there. They should not be selling these games for $70 or $60 or whatever. These should be part of a relatively affordable subscription where you're going to get little nuggets of engagement, but you're going to have it consistently because you're going to have a lot of content coming. Just that content is consumed quickly as opposed to Call of Duty, which you get thousands of hours of playtime per year per user, right?
Yeah, that's a big calculus problem for someone in management, right? It's like, it's how sacrificing box units for recurring revenue and can they retain users in that ecosystem with the kind of games they have? Maybe it's a cheap subscription, but it's worth thinking about for sure.
Great. All right. So maybe just shifting to future outlook for the company, and I'm going to try to bring, you know, as a game developer perspective, but at the same time, I'm very biased. So, and some of my views are a little bit extreme. But having said that, I think that for me, the way I think about Embracer's business right now is really in the context, as we kind of opened, about this transition in terms of the environment, right? So no longer being a ZERP environment, when I look at their business and I see negative organic growth really across the board, and if they're not able to M&A additional growth, then that's, you know, very, very troubling, I would say.
Yeah, they are not available.
Right. And
that's not even a question.
And I just think that Lars, you know, he didn't get Mark Zuckerberg's age of efficiency sort of playbook early enough. I do think he saw this a little bit too late. Now, having said that, you know, just as a person, and I've had the opportunity to do a few podcasts with Lars, I think he's an awesome guy. I think that he seems like a good person trying to do good things. And I really like the ambition of what he was trying to do with Embracer. But yeah, so maybe what we could do is just kind of look at the various businesses and kind of like speak to each. But as far as what's left of Embracer, I mean, one thing to highlight is that they still do have a lot of IP in an age where IP is becoming increasingly important. And so I think that number is still around 850 different game IPs and things like that. And to the point that you made, Brian, earlier about restructuring, I don't know exactly what they're doing from a restructuring perspective besides selling off assets, but I do think that there needs to be some level of restructuring at the operational level, that the model that you spoke of, Matthew, as far as being kind of hands-off versus the Zynga model of at least having like some kind of central team that helps some of these studios learn best practices in some way of becoming more operationally efficient or more operationally effective so that you're not continuing to see delays and things like that. And sometimes
an easy one that's a layup is like, there's no centralized publishing. Like every of these studio organizations has their own publishing arm. And like that just makes no sense. Yeah. Right. And like, you know, all large gaming, AAA HD console publishers, centralized publishing, centralized finance. Like these are the easy things that can be done, let alone like more strategic synergistic things.
Yeah. And just speaking honestly as a game developer and someone who I think of myself as someone who's able to have very hard discussions and able to do things in a pretty dramatic way to save our business. But even then, sometimes we need a kick in the ass, you know, sometimes. And so I'm not sure if there is, whether it's Lars or some central group, to go in and really like I just am not convinced whether their operational model across all of their studios, whether they have enough guidance or that central function of somebody going in and helping them with best practices or giving them a kick in the ass is good enough. So there's that part. And then maybe just kind of thinking about each of their operational divisions. So on the console and PC side, I do think losing Borderlands was a huge loss. And Brian, you mentioned some of the titles that you like Remnant 2. It's probably worth mentioning some of the other titles that are kind of bigger for them, which are like Hot Wheels Unleashed, Dead Island 2, Goat Simulator, Star Trek Online, Deep Rock Galactic, Valheim, Neverwinter, Payday 3. They also have Warhammer, Space Marine, Homeworld 3. So they, you know, and then I think the big thing is the Lord of the Rings stuff, right? And so I guess that would be the title that I have my eye on the most. I think, Matthew, you mentioned they've got a lot in the pipeline. And so 19 AAA games by April 2026 is the current plan, and then 31 AAA projects for fiscal 27 or 28. So maybe the best way to characterize this is that they've got a lot of optionality. And so if you are a potential investor, the way to think about your outlook for this part of the business, which Brian, I think you're saying is probably the division that has the biggest impact on their business, is to really look at those titles and the studios and your outlook in terms of the quality of those studios and the ability for those games to actually have success would probably dictate the future success of the entire company.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And further to that, they have a lot more IP now than they have development prowess to make it. So really, if there is a central function, one of them ought to be, and I'm sure they are, working on ways to, you know, farm out that IP to other studios that could make a difference there, or, you know, selling more of it or whatever else. But it just, gaming does not do well with content that's stagnant for long periods of time. And so you have just this window of maybe it's 5 or 10 years, but after that, if you haven't released a game in 5 or 10 years, you're kind of smoked, right? Yeah. So like the game, like for instance, like Saints Row, like we're talking earlier, if that lapses for another 3 years, and then they have a sequel in 2028, no one's going to care anymore. It's like I'll be dead or, you know, retired or something. But I really want one of those to come out again. Matt, you're on mute.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say that game hasn't been relevant for like 15 years. I know they released a new one, but it did nothing because it hasn't been relevant. So it's like I fully agree with you. They have all this IP, but how much of it is actually valuable? Like, I don't know. A lot of these, like Valheim was a COVID one-hit wonder. You can't reliably predict that that's going to be successful in a sequel, right? Like a lot of these games that were successful were COVID one-hit wonders. And when you take those out, Goat Simulator was kind of a meme game. I don't know if you can reliably replicate that, right? Like Hot Wheels, okay, whatever. It's a popular IP with kids, sure. But like kids games is a limited market, right? Unless you're building on Roblox, which is a different story. But like, I think, you know, overall, it's back to the point that none of these jump out as 15 million unit selling opportunities. Like nothing in this pipeline jumps out to me and says they're going to make several hundred million dollars in one game. And that doesn't interest me, honestly.
Yeah, Valheim was probably the best shot at that, but it was a low ASP. You could play that game for 2,000 hours and never spend another dime, right? And there wasn't much of a content path post to monetize, or if any. I kind of lapsed after 3 months or whatever and haven't been back. But yeah, those kind of games aren't going to change the dynamics of the business. And I would say very, very small percentage chance of a hit game coming out of their mobile backdrop. So yeah, it has to be PC console.
Right. And so speaking of mobile, maybe shifting there, what we see from Embracer are just like the other categories, a bunch of studios, Easy Brain, a strategy game developer, Thinking Ape, who, you know, I think we all are good friends and love Tabor. So hopefully they do really well and we're rooting for him. Crazy Labs, focusing on hyper casual. And Deca Games has been, they've got a little bit of a different strategy, which is to go out and acquire a lot of older games and then live operate them. And if I were to think about the mobile business, I would say like the big headwinds here is more on the hyper-casual side, so more around Crazy Labs. And especially if we think about the potential for a bigger impact on hyper-casual, we're already seeing an impact on hyper-casual today, but post whatever happens with fingerprinting, depending on how that goes, that could have an even bigger impact on their mobile business. And just in general, mobile is pretty tough right now. Just in terms of, you know, the success on mobile does seem to be pretty rough. I think it's going to get better, but I would say just to simplify, you've got a tough operating and success environment for mobile. You've got potentially a sector in mobile that one of their main studios is big at and which might be declining. And so overall, I would say, I guess just reinforcing the theme that for Embracer, it might be, you know, PC console or bust. And on the mobile side, I do think they're going to remain to be a little bit challenged as much as we're rooting for them, especially a Thinking Ape. I don't know if you guys have any other thoughts there before we jump into tabletop, which I don't understand at all.
I haven't dug too much into the mobile games because it is quite small relatively. Right. Look, I think from an IP perspective, like, is there room to license IP and make IP games based on mostly Lord of the Rings, but anything else, like, potentially? But again, like, you know, we have to see it to believe it, right?
Okay.
That's kind of, I mean, but yes, like, in theory, there's, but he had made a Lord of the Rings game and it did nothing, right? So I don't even know. Who knows?
Right. And then tabletop, as you mentioned, Matthew, now today, I think last year, tabletop comprised 35% of the revenue for the last fiscal year. So it's just like, that was a shocker for me. I was like, wow, is this a, this is kind of like a tabletop company.
Tabletop games is a real business. Like, yeah. they bought, like, I think the largest Asmodee, is it French pronounced?
No idea.
I think was the largest tabletop games maker in the world when they bought it. Right. Like Settlers of Catan, Ticket to Ride,
yeah.
You know, Exploding Kittens. Like, these are staples in my household. I have them all in my basement, like in my game room.
Right.
So, like, you know, these are all, and Star Wars Legion, if you're into that stuff. So they have, like, and they also have, like, distribution rights for lots of big games as well. Yep. So, like, this is a real business. And you know, argue the price that they paid for it to the end of the day, which we can, but, like, this is a real business that has real revenue and profit with it.
Right. It's a big group, 2,500 people, 22 internal studios, and 397 IP, of which Matthew mentioned the biggest ones. But in terms of the profitability of that business, what is it looking like, guys? I actually don't know. Like, is it a relatively okay or attractive business?
Yeah, I wrote it down. It's, I think it came out, I'm just pulling it. Where did I write it? It had an EBITDA or EBIT margin of 19%. So, like, pretty good.
Okay.
I would say for, like, selling, like, physical goods, consumer products, like, 19% is pretty good.
Okay. All right. So that's really it. Like, they also do have the entertainment and services segment. As I mentioned, that's more like comic books and kind of physical games and things for consoles and things like that. But just so we don't bore the audience here, we'll go ahead and skip that. But I guess netting all of that out, my outlook would be kind of a little bit grim, but just really, again, as per our discussion on the PC console side, I think it's really going to boil down to your outlook as far as the studios that are, at least for me, that are working on some of the titles that have the potential to really break out based upon the IP, like Lord of the Rings or things like that. I don't know those studios. I haven't really looked at them that closely. So it's, for me, that's what it kind of boils down to. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think for me, this may sound strange, but I think they're past the point almost where this company makes sense to run in public markets. And I think if the situation gets a bit more distressed or there's a prolonged weakness in the stock, this would be a very good take private deal. Give this 3 to 5 years of work without the stress of public markets. Start building up those central services, figure out, like, we're joking about tabletop and I don't play games like that. And I don't want to, but I imagine they have big audiences and I imagine they would be adapted well to video games. This entertainment and services division, there's a lot of money to be had in video games going into traditional media like Netflix and things like that. So giving that 3 to 5 years and then re-IPOing or whatever else, I think makes a lot of sense. I hope we don't get there because that would also be a bit disruptive to the industry and things like that. But, you know, right now it's like catching a falling knife and I have enough bloody hands.
What do you think about Embracer as a takeout target for Matthew? You mentioned a lot of their titles.
Private only. Okay. I can't see this thing going to like another video game company. There's like just Microsoft? Too much stuff.
Savvy bought a stake in it before it tanked.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like, at the time, the rumor was they're buying a stake to take the whole thing out and they're going to make Embracer like a big part of their strategy. Since then, they bought Scopely and they've done other things. So don't know if that's necessarily going to happen. I think if the valuation stays depressed, and they can start to right the ship, like that could maybe become a thing. Like, and Saudis have effectively unlimited money to spend, so like you never know with them. Other than that, like it would have to be some sort of management buyout MBO. And
yeah, you know, I don't think another publisher would want to take it on. There's just too many, you know, their publishing arm is not too dissimilar from like what Take-Two does with Private Division and things, right? Like they throw a lot of things at the wall, but I think Take-Two has enough there. EA is very focused on big franchises. It's just, it doesn't fit well into the narratives of those other companies. And, you know, maybe the price isn't too bad. Maybe it's $3 billion or something like that, but you're inheriting the debt. You're inheriting a lot of employees. Talk about an integration nightmare, right? Like, Embracer has more employees than some of those companies I just mentioned. So it would be quite a, yeah.
I was gonna say the difference between Take-Two Private Division, you're a publisher. Like you don't have to, you don't have the risk of the R&D and the development, right? You get 30% or whatever of everything that's sold. And so like you have very incremental cost in distribution, right? But you know, so I agree with you in a sense of the games that are coming out of those businesses are gonna be similar, but the economics are very different, right?
What do you guys think for like a Microsoft or a Sony? Does it make sense for them at all or no?
Same idea. It's just too much stuff.
Embracer should want to put their content in Game Pass because it's probably a better way for them to distribute it and get more eyeballs, especially like after the launch window, right? I think Valheim came to Game Pass at one point. I have to double check. Or one of those services, right? And then you saw another wave of engagement, right? Like that makes a lot of sense for these games. And whether they do their own service or, you know, after 3 months, they then make it available inside of Game Pass or something. Like these games that are only going to sell a couple million units, that's a good way to get incremental revenue off your catalog, especially if you have some live ops plan. You can time it around a live ops drop and monetize, you know, whatever live ops you have in plan, whatever expansion DLC. So I think that there are ways to kind of, you know, expand the reach of some of these games, but again, nothing individually moves the needle. And I think that's the difficult thing where we'll talk about Ubisoft in a second. Like you look at a company like Ubisoft, you can identify, here's like two or three games that if these take off, the whole business changes, right? And they're in a different stratosphere. And you don't have that with Embracer.
Okay. All right, with that, we can close the loop here on Embracer and move on to our second company, which is Ubisoft. As I mentioned, I think in particular, the Embracer-Ubisoft contrast is quite interesting, which we'll go into. And I actually wrote a post that went a bit viral. It actually got copied and a lot of my diagrams just got scattered all over the place on social media. But it was actually based on a recommendation from you, Matthew, when we were talking about Ubisoft and you suggested that we look at Ubisoft's revenue per employee. And basically when it comes to that metric, Ubisoft is actually dead last of at least public companies as far as I know, and probably still valid today, which means that when we're looking at revenue per employee, it really suggests, and their last meaning that they make the least amount of revenue per employee, that it's kind of a gauge on their employee efficiency. And just similar to kind of Embracer, I do think they didn't get the age of efficiency note. And so they've been moving pretty late to kind of try to right their operational efficiency, which I think just industry-wide is something that, again, during the age of ZERP and easy money was not a focus, but now companies just have to be more efficient. And that's something that I think that when I look at Ubisoft, I do think that that's their biggest problem. I know that that post did create a lot of folks who don't like me too much from Ubisoft, but hopefully you don't hate me. I was actually hoping that that post would not necessarily be like, ha ha, you know, screw you guys. I was hoping that it would be a little bit of a wake-up call for some of those guys to agitate for more change, because Ubisoft does have great products, right? And I'm just to be clear, I'm a fan of the industry. I would love to see Ubisoft be great and to make great products. I just don't think that the current path for them, as I pointed out very early last year, clearly they're kind of reacting to it now, but I just wish they would have reacted to it earlier. And I'm not sure if they're going to be doing enough. Now, speaking about the strategy of the company, go ahead.
I just want to add one thing on that. What you're describing with Ubisoft, where you know, this operational misstructuring. Like a lot of companies overgrew during COVID and now have to shrink. This has been a problem for Ubisoft for many years. This is not a new issue in the sense of they have this massive scale of developer base and they don't effectively leverage it. And even in the times when they were releasing really good games and hitting record numbers, like I think when you ran those numbers, it was in a down year where they had some delayed games, so the revenue was down and everything. Even if you look at their numbers in a good year, they still don't stack up against EA and Take-Two and Activision on revenue per employee, profit per employee, whatever metric you want to look at. And I think that's an important kind of set of context as well, as this is not just a recent issue for them. They've had a long-standing issue of operational inefficiencies. And I think that's an important consideration just to have as part of this.
And maybe, again, bringing my game developer perspective here, maybe I could characterize that a little bit better. So when I say they're not very efficient, what does that actually mean? And so actually, the conversation I first had with Matthew at the beginning of last year, when I was even thinking about or discussing Ubisoft, was in the context that when I went to LA, I talked to a lot of game developers, as I do when I travel to LA. And I just kept hearing this feedback from various folks in LA, like, oh my God, this another Ubisoft guy, never hire Ubisoft guys. They are so political. They're so inefficient. And what they mean is that, so taking Supercell as the complete opposite, right? So one end of the spectrum, you've got Supercell, very small teams, compact, cross-functional, meaning one person could potentially be doing very different jobs. And then at the other side of the spectrum, you have Ubisoft who, and again, look, I haven't worked at Ubisoft. Don't kill the messenger. I'm just telling you guys what I hear. I have worked with an Ubisoft guy before, and I did notice these tendencies, which is like that they have sliced up roles very, very finely. Like this person does this thing, this person does this thing, this person does this thing. And you can't touch or comment on that other person's thing, or it becomes very political. And it's in, like people would be asking permission, like, oh, can I do this? Can I do that? Can I talk to you about this? Can I talk to that person? And it's just like the overhead in terms of so many sliced up responsibilities and all the communications overhead to just even coordinate trying to do something between one thing and another is massive. And so in that context, when you then look at things like revenue per employee and Ubisoft is dead last, then you're like, okay, the way that they are operating and developing kind of doesn't make sense in an age of efficiency, right? Where sure, everyone can have their sliced up roles and they can own their little thing. And you've got all this communication overhead. And I'm sure these guys are probably sitting in meetings just because of the way that they do their development, but I'm sure they're sitting in like tons and tons and tons of meetings and have to coordinate and things like that. So you've got massive overhead for that kind of development model. Anyway, okay, I probably speaking a little bit too much for that, but just for our audience, so you kind of understand the context in which that inefficiency potentially exists at Ubisoft, that's what I'm talking about. Now, let's talk about the strategy, which again, I believe is a really interesting contrast to Embracer. In the strategy, according to their CEO, and I can't pronounce his name, but something like Yves Guillemot. But basically,
that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
So he basically, the strategy that he describes is very simple. It's two things. First, expanding the reach of big brand games. So for example, the Assassin's Creed franchise. So as Matthew pointed out before, focusing on kind of these big titles that have the potential to kind of explode. And secondly, building a recurring revenue model through live games such as Rainbow Six Siege. So big titles, and then let's try to do live operations, which is, again, very different from Embracer, where they're not trying to go for those big titles. Well, maybe they are with Lord of the Rings. But and then I'm not sure if on the PC console side, they're pushing as much on live services. But anyway, it's an interesting the similarities as far as Ubisoft and Embracer is in terms of like their platform mix, right? So they also develop games for console, PC, and mobile. They also have an entertainment X game, so not games division, involved in movies. So from a product mix perspective, besides the tabletop stuff, I would say that they are very similar. Unlike Embracer, Ubi has, for whatever reason, and maybe we'll see this through the financials, they've seen a sharp decline in console and PC, but seems like a bigger boost in mobile. And besides that, Ubisoft, like Embracer, is huge. They have Ubisoft studios scattered across like over 30 countries. And as far as the kind of upcoming titles for fiscal 24, you've got kind of like, again, aligning with that company strategy, Avatar, Frontiers of Pandora, Assassin's Creed Mirage, Assassin's Creed Nexus for VR, Just Dance 2024, Prince of Persia, The Lost Crown, and Skull and Bones. And on that second piece of their strategy, as far as live ops and recurring revenue free to play, you've got Rainbow Six Mobile, The Division Resurgence, and something called X Defiant. So with that, that's kind of like a high level, simple encapsulation of their business. And I'll kick it over to you, Brian, to talk about the financials.
Yeah, okay. Let's dive in here. So their last full financial year was 2022 to 2023. They closed their fiscal in the March quarter, which will be reported next month on or around May 15th. Last fiscal, they did 1.74 billion euros in net bookings, which was down 18% versus the prior year, 2021-2022. So going down the income statement, COGS at 217 million euro, leaving 1.5 billion in gross profit, about 87.5% margins, all good. And now this is where things start to get a little hairy, as JK alluded to with headcount. R&D is 80% of net bookings. SG&A, another 36% of net bookings. You can do that math really quick. The company lost half a billion euros for the year. This is a stark contrast to the year prior, where they made just over $400 million.
I would just add a lot of this was driven by game delays. They delayed a lot of games at that point in time. So revenue came down a lot, right? You saw that in the numbers. And so obviously you lose that operating leverage. So that's an important consideration, but I want to touch on that because that's a bigger part of the Ubisoft story when you're done going through the numbers.
Yep. And then R&D for 22-23 was almost 80% higher year over year, obviously with some leverage there, in a year with 18% lower revenue. So an investment year and a down revenue year. So it's hard to say whether or not that was a mistake necessarily until we learn what the R&D produces. So let's keep moving. In Q3, those numbers came down a bit with R&D expenses at 49% of net bookings. Part of that's due to higher year-on-year revenue, but also because headcount came down a bit to 19,400 versus 20,000 in the year prior, but it's still double the staff they employed in the 2014 to 2016 timeframe. So all told, R&D plus SG&A expenses remain about 15 points higher than historical norms. As I said, 2020 and 21 was a banner year for Ubisoft, just like for the rest of the gaming industry. They did 2.24 billion euros in net bookings for 46% year-on-year growth. They followed that up with 2.21 billion in 2021-2022. That's down 5%. Then, as mentioned, a big gap down to 1.74 billion in 22-23. So these prior results are important to the setup, so move into that. At a high level, Ubisoft has been a bit cryptic on guidance lately, using words over hard numbers. They initially guided net bookings for strong growth year over year. So one could assume something like mid-teens growth off 1.74 billion. So we can just call that 2 billion for a nice round number. On net income, which is a proxy for euro EBITDA, basically, they've guided that to 400 million euros versus, again, the 400 million loss the year prior. First half 23 bookings of 822 million euro were reported last fall, which is a mid-teens acceleration on their prior compare. Then they guided Q3 to 610 million and delivered 626 million, which is a pretty solid beat. So a quick math on that is 822 plus 626 is 1448, means you need 522 million to go for the full year. But they changed their outlook on the 2022 and 2023 revenue growth, suggesting that Q4 would be sharply up, leading to record annual net bookings. And it's worth noting this was in the remarks, not the formal press release. So their prior record on annual bookings, as we just mentioned, was 2240 million euro. And then running the math, and that again suggests they need to deliver 792 million euros in Q4, which is a big number for Ubisoft. So now let's step into the revenue story. Q3 was actually quite good. Over the last year, they've launched 4 frontline games to strong reviews or strong-ish reviews. Those have booked about $400 million revenue over the first 3 quarters. It's Assassin's Creed Mirage, Avatar, The Crew, and then Prince of Persia. And I think that slate of games kind of underscores what Ubisoft excels at, right? Like huge, gorgeous, expansive maps that can easily eat up 200 hours of playtime, episodic layering into microtransactions on top of premium games with low attach rates. And it's also worth noting that adventure content that ages well and most gamers find themselves playing over time, but not always with urgency, right? Like there's a variety of methods to consume over subscription, the full ASP on release, obviously, or deep bundles and discounts in the catalog. Now, the gem in Q3 was the continued strength of the back catalog, which is driving nearly 3/4 of bookings for 2023 to 2024. And it was up a staggering 40% year on year. Part of that strength was a halo effect for Assassin's Creed, given they had a new release. But the major strength has been Rainbow Six. R6 was released back in December of 2015, so almost a decade in operation. Lately, it's been back in the top 10 games based on current players on Steam. Average players almost doubled in March from February, hitting levels they haven't seen since April of 2020. This is pandemic lockdown time period. And this was driven by deep discounts. The game was on sale for $4 and a week of free access. So this was the first substantial price cut for R6 over that 10-year period, which monetizes heavily on MTX for character packs and seasonal content, and it could be a candidate for a true free-to-play push. So this game has arguably been, you know, Ubisoft's biggest live operation success of all time. So all told, we've got some momentum heading into Q4, but with a almost 800 million euro nut to crack, with the catalog on pace to maybe print half of that. So what's entering the model for the quarter? Prince of Persia Lost Crown, which is a premium box sale ranging from $50 to $60, no MTX. It's a side-scroller game, kind of like Metroid, decently well-reviewed, but kind of a lid on it, given you know it's not multiplayer, no MTX. Skull and Bones, which was announced at E3 back when I still worked in financial services, so this is like eons ago. The reviews are absolutely heinous. I have a hard time even reading the reviews. I'm getting bored. But you know, I guess one silver lining here is that Ubisoft has been pretty proficient at making bad launches decent over time. Like Division and R6 both kind of come to mind, but that's a really hard way to live. They also expected a limited contribution from X Defiant. That's the game that Joe mentioned earlier. That's a free-to-play shooter being mildly dubbed the COD killer, and according to management, was going to have a limited contribution. As of 3 weeks ago, the game has been delayed, so this will be a zero. But you know, worth noting, they have a server test session starting tomorrow night on Friday through 4/21 to prepare for launch. So really, going into the quarter, you're leaning on Prince of Persia and the 3 other games we mentioned to have a healthy sell-through, and also some outliers like the significant partnerships they've talked about ad nauseum, including non-exclusive rights for the console and PC Activision distribution over a 15-year time period. So the setup into numbers here is like, you know, Ubisoft's down 13% year-to-date. Q's are up 5, EA's down 7.5, Take-Two's down 10 to 11. The stock has clearly been faded on game delays and reviews, particularly on Skull and Bones. And that sentiment has led to concerns of a miss on the full year 24 bookings guidance. That's the 800 million they have left. And then potentially adjusted EBIT, of which the recognition of licensing agreements would be a major driver. And there's also some expectations to give full year 25 targets, basically. Is this going to be another peak year in Ubisoft's fiscal heading into a trough? And you know, that's not necessarily what investors want to see, like the stock trades at a discount, but that's why. And then anybody have anything to say there?
Yeah, I'll jump in before you go into kind of 25 and the guidance and what we're going to expect from the new games. Like, I'd also just point out Avatar was December 7th. So yes, it's going to be front loaded, but in theory, they're going to get more unit sales in the March quarter from that. So that helps you get some of that number as well. But I think, you know, if you just look at the games that are contributing, right, it speaks to the overall kind of strategic question of Ubisoft. And I remember in our friend Jeff Cohen, shout out Jeff, he and I, when we first met, was at an E3 at a Ubisoft investor event. We sat next to each other. And they basically showed a slide that I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was along, I actually probably have the slide deck here, probably find it, but it was along this, was along the lines of, if our games sell more units, we're more profitable. If each game just sells more units and we get more scale, we're more profitable. Well, no shit. That was like our joint reaction at the same time. And I think you look at the games, like if they just focused on Assassin's Creed, maybe Avatar, probably Star Wars, Division, R6, and got away from these games like The Crew, which is more like the Embracer type games, only going to sell a couple million units, right? Prince of Persia, right? Like, yes, these are nice to have games, but these are the games that, similar to Embracer, you don't get the economies of scale. You don't have live ops attached to it, right? And so, like, I remember, what was Assassin's Creed Valhalla, I think, was the most successful Assassin's Creed of all time. Yes, it was COVID, so they obviously had a boost, but it also had, probably in my opinion, as someone who's played a lot of them, the best live ops of any of the games in the franchise in terms of how the map was done and how the live ops was done and the story. And, you know, I think when they have these big expansive live ops games, they're very successful. The problem is you can't reliably trust them to release them on time. You can't reliably trust them to release them at quality. And then they have all these other games that, like, you just question why. Like Skull and Bones, any other company would have killed that 5 years ago. When it would, I think this was like reported on Kotaku or something. You can go read like what happened with the Singapore team that was building it. I'm pretty sure they started the team thrice over. So like the team got restarted and then restarted again. And like, I think the game got restarted like six different times. Like any other company would have trashed that after maybe two of those, right? And so it just, there's all sorts of questions strategically around, like, yes, they want to build these big games that have live ops and monetization, but then they still do these weird, like The Crew. There was an extreme sports game they did recently, like a couple of years ago. It was like a snowboarding game. It's like, why?
Yeah. JK, anything?
No.
We're going to the 25 titles?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So we just mentioned, right, like, investors want to see this handoff from 24 to 25, suggesting, I'm not saying this thing has to grow precipitously off of a high base or a record high, but even like down 10%, down 15%, like what are we looking at? So here's the titles I have coming out. The first one is Assassin's Creed, codename Jade. This is the mobile open world action adventure free-to-play title. It's an RPG. It's being developed by Level Infinite and Tencent, probably the most leverage of the group, the most potential anyway, if it's done right. But I can also see a million reasons why this could. Assassin's Creed, codename Red. This is a premium flagship AC game set in feudal Japan that should maybe be up there with Valhalla if it comes out and does well. Star Wars Outlaws, which is a September-ish timeframe, a third-person action-adventure game being built by Massive Entertainment, and they're best known for the Division series games. The kicker here is that it's a single-player game, which kind of puts a low ceiling on units again. The trade-off is it's Star Wars, so maybe that brings in a good audience. Division Resurgence, this is Ubisoft's attempt at shifting one of their better IPs into mobile and free-to-play, and it's also approved for release in China. I've watched some videos. It has some similarities to both Division titles. And while it could expand the audience, I'd say my expectations for this one to be a commercial success are measured. I'd probably rather see Ubisoft investing in a proper Division 3 or licensing mobile development like they did with Assassin's Creed to other folks versus developing ports in-house. There's also a forward event on June 10th that could serve as a catalyst for dates or hype around existing releases. So the biggest debate again here is, like, investors don't care much about the current year peak growth story. So how are we going to see sustained growth in 2025? Well, there's also R6 Mobile, September of 24, and that's built by Montreal. So another internal studio building a mobile game. Anything there before we talk about valuation and the call here?
I think a lot of these games are promising. I mean, I can't recall like a core Assassin's Creed game that was an utter flop. I think they do a very good job. I think there have been degrees of success within the franchise, but it's largely been successful. And I don't really ever question their ability to release mainline Assassin's Creed games. Mirage was not a mainline game, right? It was kind of like a double A quality. It wasn't like a full triple A Assassin's Creed game, if I remember correctly, right? And so like, this is like the first triple A, like fully immersive one since Valhalla. And so like, you know, I think this is very exciting, and this is a game that you can kind of, as much as you can with Ubisoft, kind of like have confidence is going to live up to expectations, because they're very good at these. You know, I think the mobile game, I'm not sure, because it's not really a genre that like I'm curious what it looks like and how they adapt the IP for mobile. Cause like a mobile action game, like doesn't.
You're like, talking Jade, Assassin's Creed Jade.
I'm curious to like see what it looks like and how they tweak the IP to be more mobile centric and monetized. And JK, maybe you can jump in here, but like I just don't see a traditional Assassin's Creed game. Like if they just make an Assassin's Creed game on mobile, like I don't see how that works as a mobile game, right?
I feel like they caught like the Genshin bug.
And yeah,
it's like 10 cents. If they do something like that,
then I can definitely see it working. But like, yeah. I'm just curious what it looks
like. That only costs $200 million to build. Like,
well, Tencent's building it. So
yeah. So yeah, I think I think the more, to your point, Brian, I completely agree with you. Like, the Chinese just dominate in terms of being able to create high quality experiences on mobile. As far as I can tell, with respect to R6 mobile, right? Like, I haven't seen a successful Western company build a very high quality shooter yet, a very successful one yet. I mean, it's all out of China. So in being developed out of Montreal, moving to like 4-day work weeks, I just don't know. I think they're going to continue to see delays, and it's tough. Like, you know, I have personally spoken to some of the engineers that have worked on some of these shooter games, and man, these guys are like, they're at another level. These guys are way pro. So yeah, I'm a little bit fearful for them in terms of some of their mobile titles, but you know, obviously wish them the best of luck. I agree with you, Brian. I think that the better strategy is just to partner with China for some of those bigger IPs.
Yeah, I'd say like Division to me, I would put almost nothing next to that in my numbers. R6 mobile, almost nothing. Jade, I think, is an outlier. It could be really big, or it could
be. But it's made by Tencent, so that's right. That's a different ball.
Yeah.
I think Star Wars is going to do well. I mean, to your point that it's a single player game, it's not going to have a lot of live ops. But like we've seen, very successful Star Wars single player game from Respawn recently. Yeah. The last couple, the Fallen Order games, right? And so, like, I think this game will do well. I fully expect it to be broken as shit when it launches. And it's gonna take time to actually be playable, but it will sell well. I'm fairly certain.
Yeah, I would say that those three, Jade, Red, Outlaws, all have some potential. And then, of course, like I said, June 10th, we'll see what else they have packed away for the year.
But I would also go back to your overall thesis and what you were kind of saying about the outlook is like, this is all very exciting for 25, but to your point, like, okay, you've emptied the tank. Are we back to are you going to go through a period of 3 years again where it's kind of nothing before we get another year like this? Or is there more in the tank? And I think to your point, the forward event on June 10th is going to say a lot to that. It's going to tell us, it's going to confirm stuff for fiscal 25, but I think it's also going to give us a preview to 26, given that they have the two studios for Assassin's Creed that operate on 3-year cycles. So we should expect another Assassin's Creed probably in 26, right? Because they'll have Red, which is the Japan game, and that's the mainline one. So they probably should have another mainline, fully AAA Assassin's Creed in 26. So assuming all of that, you can at least kind of hang your hat on that again. But I agree with you. Like, you know, they're kind of emptying the tank. Star Wars is done. Avatar is done. All these like big games that we were kind of, you know, banking on. And so what else is there? Beyond Good and Evil 2, like I know that's kind of like a cult. Everyone wants that game, but like it's been kind of on ice for like 5 years now. So like, you know, who knows what's next?
It's been a stretch since we've had a good Far Cry 2. That would make sense for 25 maybe. Who knows? We'll see. But it's a catalyst path if nothing else.
Valuation?
So the
go ahead.
Yeah, valuation I would say is undemanding. It's about 3 to 3.5 EV EBITDA versus the peer median group of 11 to 12. Again, I'm not saying it deserves to be in the peer median group by any stretch, but I think a 70% discount is potentially a little bit too much. Some of that's warranted, right? Choppy growth, bad execution, the fears of the 25 rollover, but they do have a lot of strategic value in IP. we're also in this gaming bear market right now, or a gaming recession from a variety of vectors. And I don't think that will last forever. But we're also seeing, like, look, the stock's bombed out. I think if this thing looks like earnings are a little bit better than feared and the setup looks pretty good, a decent catalyst path after that, the June 10th reveal. And I don't think they need to talk up raucous growth in 25 for the stock to work. It's still like, it's a smaller name now. It's not a ton of liquidity, but this one, I don't have too much of a problem stepping into, at least for a partial position.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think it's interesting. And I got my little Ash and my little, you know, Mario Rabbit here for Ubisoft out there. You know, I agree. I think given the valuation, given the pipeline that's coming, the stock like this does tend to rally into good years like this, even though you start to then look ahead at kind of what's beyond it. But at least in the near term, with, you know, earnings coming, they'll give the guidance for next year. You got the June 10th event. We'll build the hype for the games coming. August is Star Wars, right? You probably enter a cycle that's conducive to some sort of an upcycle. And if you look historically, Ubisoft stock has kind of gone through these cycles, and the stock kind of goes with the hype cycle. So, but I think once you kind of get close to Star Wars, and then towards like the end of calendar 24, we really need to know what fiscal 26 looks like. So beyond March of 25, to kind of, even with Assassin's Creed coming later in the year, like that's going to start to get priced in, especially as we have more visibility as to what the game looks like. And until we kind of know what's after that, it's going to raise a lot of question marks. I think it's similar to like a dynamic with Take-Two at this point, where we're just kind of waiting for GTA 6. And whereas like Take-Two rides the GTA 6 hype cycle now. And, you know, the joke is always every time there's a GTA cycle, you just buy Take-Two on every dip until basically the game comes out, and then you sell it when the game comes out. And to a degree, that might work with Ubisoft here and with Star Wars and Assassin's Creed. But, you know, I'm still skeptical of the execution. They've significantly struggled with execution in the past. You can never reliably rely on them to release games on time, and you can never rely on them to do it at quality. They have a track record of fixing broken games after launch, but Brian, you said it before, like that's not a way to build your business, right? So it's, especially with mobile, they've never done before, and all these things they're doing and trying to push live services, you know, in games that it hasn't necessarily worked in before. That's kind of just where I get cautious down the road if the valuation moves higher and the stock moves higher, right? But at this valuation, I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of safety room, a lot of safety net built into the valuation here.
Yeah, I feel like it'd be a different story if they were just architected from a headcount perspective to just launch codename Jade, codename Red, and Star Wars. We'd be having a different conversation, because these mobile 100%. Games to me just seem like...
There's all these studio, and again, I'm sure these are wonderful people, and I'm not like bashing the people. The crew, I forget what the extreme sports game was, the South Park games that they've done, the Stick of Truth, like why? Like, it's just not worth the investment. Like, you're not earning, the investment dollars are better spent on improving the live ops of Assassin's Creed than they are on South Park. Like, that's just how I look at it.
Right. Okay, so maybe we could wrap with just like maybe a little bit more, and maybe I could provide a little potentially controversial takes as far as their outlook is concerned. But I would agree with you guys as far as the conclusions you're reaching. The overall strategy I like for them in terms of focusing on big titles, maybe to your point, Matthew, they could be doing more of that and being more laser focused, and, you know, having an orientation where they're trying to develop capabilities around live services, live games is right. But just kind of going back and maybe bringing up a few things as far as more macro what's happening, I think some of the trends are not playing into their favor. So what, like, there is a kind of maybe not so controversial take, but there has been a lot of discussion about how games are going increasingly bigger budget. And as the budgets get bigger, those teams become more risk averse, leading to potentially not so great game designs and products ultimately because of the risk aversion. We've seen over the last year, a lot of these small one-person to three-person studios develop number one hits on Steam. So whether that's Valheim or BattleBit or Lethal Company or games like that, what we're starting to see is that maybe this model of bigger budgets with risk aversion may not be the right approach. And it seems that if you stack that on top of their lack of efficiency and operational effectiveness, wow, is that not a great strategic position to be in? And I think as far as where the industry potentially is headed, when we think about things like AI and the ability for smaller and smaller teams to become more agile and to develop better and better experiences, then I think from a structural perspective, the way that their culture has been established of, you know, as I mentioned before, finally slicing up roles and not being very efficient and having all this overhead, I just think that they're playing into a longer term, very rough situation. I think the future is against them from an operational perspective. And I think we're going to continue to see delays in production and execution and things like that. And again, I'm not trying to be super negative. I'm not trying to like overly criticize them. But the reason why I would bring these things up is I would hope that they actually really take a look at this and think about their future so that they're not super late in terms of restructuring and things like that, which they were. So with that, I would say I am bearish on Ubisoft, although I wish the best for them. I don't know. What do you guys think about some of the, you know, again, concerns from a game development perspective?
Yeah, I think some of this stuff in their pipeline feels, you know, extraordinarily reactive to me, okay, right? Like they're seeing games that have like I mentioned Genshin, right? They're seeing games with similar game styles that are doing big numbers out there. And like, oh, well, we have an IP that could plug into that. We always wanted Assassin's Creed to go mobile. So like, that's a logical conclusion for us. The good thing is they hired someone capable to do it, but they've had other R6 games come out. There was a side scroller that was maybe 2019 timeframe that was absolute garbage because it was homegrown. And like, again, they just don't have mobile DNA at Ubisoft whatsoever.
They tried making like a collector RPG, like a Galaxy of Heroes game with Tom Clancy.
Yeah, just stop doing that kind of stuff.
And I think Yves Guillemot's son was the producer on it, who I'm pretty sure is like an art school guy. And again, awesome. You know, this is all like public information. So like, I played it. It was horrible. Like it was like I played Galaxy of Heroes and I invested way too much money in that game, fully admitted. And I was like, let me try this because like maybe Ubisoft can hit it. Absolutely not.
Yeah, or like Division is an HD game. I don't think anyone wants to play that on mobile, and it just doesn't look great visually. Maybe it works in China, but I don't think that's a viable thing to underpin your thesis on either. And then, you know, R6 Mobile, for a game that is rewarding you 10 years after launch with some of the biggest user growth they've ever seen, an engaged community, and you want to make a mobile game? Like, didn't we learn this with Blizzard and, you know, other things in the past? It's just like, just because you have a game that does well does not mean it needs to be on mobile. They're very different form factors. They're very different specialties. And, you know, foremost, like, I'm not sure those teams are capable of making those things. And I'm not sure they want to be making them. I don't know, but they just... You know, again, like I would put a zero against those things in my model. I do agree there's a lot of holes to poke in the story around strategy and development prowess, but I still think the stock can work despite those. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive outcomes.
You know what we're due for in fiscal 26, which I forgot? Watch Dogs. We're due for a new Watch Dogs game. I think we haven't had one since 2020. So, and Watch Dogs Legion was fun to play, I will admit. They had this NPC system that they built. They called it an AI NPC system, but basically anytime you interact with an NPC, you could recruit them to your team. And like, they had just had like generative is a buzzword today, but like basically they just had a bank of like personalities that would randomly load into the NPCs. So they do cool stuff. Like, and that was a fun game. I played that way too much, more so than any Watch Dogs game anyone should play. So like, yeah, maybe we're due for a Watch Dogs game. Yeah.
It makes some really good games whenever they stick to their path and what they've been historically good at.
All right. So maybe to close this out real quick, final question, 5 years from now, who's up more, Ubisoft or Embracer? What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if Embracer will still be public in 5 years.
Yeah. Is this the second IPO?
it might go private and come back by then. That's true. I mean, Ubisoft has been rumored as a takeout candidate also. I know there was rumors with Tencent, there was rumors with private equity at some point. Okay. And, you know, it's always on the table as well. Like, I don't think you could take it off the table because Tencent does own a significant piece of Ubisoft now and has for a while. You know, politically, yeah, it might be difficult for them, but, you know, I just don't think you have enough visibility in Ubisoft that long term to be able to say that. Like with Activision before they got acquired, EA, you could at least like hang your hat on FIFA, Madden, the sports games, the live ops, right? You know, with Take-Two, you can reliably lean on, again, sports, GTA, etc. Like, I just don't think you have something that you can rely on with that level of visibility at Ubisoft or Embracer.
Right. But roughly, who do you think is doing better? I mean, there are different scales of businesses, but on a relative basis, who do you think improves more?
I'm going to go with Ubisoft just because I'm going to have to back into like just the quality of the IP and how long they've been around the industry. And, you know, it's like Embracer to me feels more like a Berkshire Hathaway that went the wrong way. I think, really, again, just pretend.
The only caveat I'll make there is that, you know, 5 years from now could be the year where they have Ubisoft as a reset again, right? Like, we could get to a point where they've exhausted the pipeline. They haven't addressed the operational issues because they haven't done it for as long as I've been following the company of any significant structural way. And then they have to reset again. And it's happened a couple times since I've been following Ubisoft as an analyst. So, you know, it's hard for me to have any certainty. I do lean with you and just say I don't think that like Embracer's model will work long term, so I'm with you, but there's always the chance that 5 years, whatever date you're picking, is the year where they have the big reset and the stock tumbles again.
So if you look at the model and break it down just by game contribution and things like that, yeah, Ubisoft has more high energy pipeline and they have higher sensitivity to big outcomes, so therefore Ubisoft. I would just leave that one.
Okay. And same on my side. I'm gonna go with Embracer. But I mean, I agree with you guys. I do think that the quality of the IP is higher with Ubisoft, but I think like I know more people and like people more than Embracer, so
I would say that if I had to take the counterpoint there, Embracer is going through an extraordinarily difficult time,
yeah,
and they're going to learn some shit from that. And if they can see through this and then get to a rates environment that's a little less punitive and pay down their debt, and Lars is still at the helm and he has this design on the gaming industry, that could be interesting. Ubisoft is never going to change, right? Yeah. It's majority owned by the CEO, and he's going to kind of keep going the path he's going and farting around until he's not anymore. So I like the executive kind of strategy and energy out of Embracer over a 5-year time period more than Ubisoft. They just don't have the same quality of games. Right.
So if you were to choose Embracer, you're basically banking on management and leadership optionality that they're going to figure some stuff out.
What if Lars runs Ubisoft?
All right. Okay. Well, I think there you have it. Embracer versus Ubisoft. You got all of our thoughts on the business. Hopefully you learned something from that. And to Brian and Matthew, thank you so much for all of your insights. And with that, we will catch you next time on Pixels and Profits. Catch you later, guys. Bye.